Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 13. The choir director was thin in the way of big-shot women. Her chic, very narrow, mannish tweed jacket made her all the more feminine. Natalie Tenebrae began, as always, by leading the group in a hymn that both synods of Lutherans, the Episcopalians, and the sprinkle of Catholics would know. Some latecomers, the slower of the aged or the irresolute poor, could get settled in the rear. The regular ecumenical choir singers pretended to take direction from Natalie. Now they were belting out Non Nubis Pacem in the canon. Rather than the round form, they belted out what they knew and jawed lightly over what they didn't know. Tenors who couldn't read music at all leaned heads toward anyone in their section who could, such as Dieter Stoltz. They took his note from him a split second late. Pearl slammed the piano keys to punish people back onto the beat when they lagged. At this last rehearsal, as last year and year before, the two heavy-set violinists with their shirt cuffs hanging loose and their imitation Norwegian knit vest bulging around their bodies played their instruments perfectly. They made no mistakes in the fingering. They studiously kept to the slash and U-bowing that Natalie had penciled in for them. One of them played with a respectable vibrato, the other with a palsied left hand jiggling. Their bows did not sail over the springs. This was hard labor, so they labored. Natalie smiled at them, cued them in and off from time to time, scolded a couple of sopranos for being flat, when they could perfectly well have trusted the violinist for their note, this with a smile at the string players. Natalie Tenebrae wore two hats till the post-Thanksgiving chorale was over. She was always the wife of the town's biggest big shot. On Sundays in the autumn, she was a glorious authoritative martinet of a music director. These annual minions of hers never received serious discipline in anything else. They smiled nervous smiles and even low laughs when Natalie Tenebrae swatted her two palms together until the male singers heard her over their own voices. "Stop, oh, for the love of God, would you stop?" she shouted. She made them listen while they sang whatever parts had disgraced basses or tenors, whichever section had got it wrong. The old people and the poor people who sat along the back wall were grateful for the new electric strip just under their seats this afternoon. "Oh, if that didn't make a difference," they exclaimed to each other. None of them really sang, but they dutifully lowered their eyes to their sheet music as Natalie berated them. They noticed everything they possibly could. If Natalie Tenebrae was scolding the others, they took the scolding too. This was Sunday afternoon, free of the Patriots, free of the Packers, both of whom were what their grandchildren came to visit if they came at all. Here, these rehearsals now were a social occasion among the other people in their own town. They remarked on everything they could. They noticed the curious presence of Arlene Strop, who cleaned houses. Her husband was in jail, arraigned and charged for shooting the Episcopal priest. They studied what they could make out of the back of her head, as if the truth about manslaughter was hidden in her somehow. She'd never been there before, not even sitting at the back with them, but here she was, big as life in that alto section. This week, the lunch, as it was called, although it was mid-afternoon and snack, was from Marty Hank's Super Value. Everyone knew the difference and similarities between food from Denham's Bakery and food from the Super Value. They liked all of it. Just thinking about it reminded them that the first half must be about over soon. The moment Natalie said, "Time to eat," Stan Garris got up and came back, told everyone back there to come right up and take a plate with the others. Ward Hines, the oldest man in the room, felt very good about that. He remembered back to when people voluntarily brought the lunch to rehearsals. One Sunday, nothing came in but Jell-O and bought and chocolate chip cookies from the Super Value. Ward remembered clearly what happened. Mr. Peter Tenebrae went to the telephone and ordered in deli. People thought the poor and the old like trans crap, as Ward's wife called it, for food. But it wasn't true. They were grateful for some protein when it was offered. In the second half of rehearsal, the director got angry. Mrs. Tenebrae swore at them. "For the love of God," she cried, "would you please stop singing when I need your attention?" At last, the couple of basses closed their mouths. They had rushed to a rehearsal from watching 2 3/4 of the Vikings game. They'd acted humble about coming into the church drunk as they were, but then they loved the sound of their voices swinging through the talus cannon. They looked sullen when Natalie told them to shut up. Natalie said, "You've got to learn to listen to someone besides yourself. Look, Pearl, go back to sea and play the bass line." She made the men repeat the bad passage. "All right, then," she called. "Tutti, everybody, try it again." The sturdy women raised their violins and bows. Natalie stopped them after a second. Natalie said, "Would you put down your music, please, and just sing with me? And just sing with me. Love divine, all loves excelling. Strings on parts 1 and 2, please. Pearl, no piano. Note, please." Pearl tapped on E flat. They all watched Natalie, all of them, sullen. But as they sang on, they cheered up. The beauty of it reached into them, and their voices began to peel upward instead of just slamming the air. Their director let them do it again. They regarded her with solemn happiness. "Oh, my dears," Natalie cried, "you're lovely when you put your minds to it. Lovely. Okay, housekeeping now." Peter came forward from the place among the basses. His wife had already turned to one side to put her music into its briefcase. She kept at it as she began to speak. Peter told them that, as they knew, they would be using the St. Fursey Church cassocks this year. He reminded them where the choir booklets would be and when to meet in the side room of the school auditorium. He turned to the violinists. "You two all clear to go?" he smiled. "Music stands? Anything else?" They reminded him that they always brought their own stands. Peter cried, "Don't forget Wednesday night, annual Veterans Evening, and it will be a very special this year, starting promptly at 7:30. A bass called up. "What time on Wednesday, then?" "He just said," snarled a couple of the sopranos in unison. 7:30, everybody. "All right," shouted Peter. "One more announcement only. As you know, at St. Fursey Episcopal Church, we have lost our rector this past week. This is a tragedy for us, not only because Eliza was so young to die, but because we loved her. Some of you who are not Episcopalians had come to love Eliza, too, in her 3 years among us all. Eliza especially loved serious music. So here is my thought for us. Let's dedicate our concert coming up to her memory and to the memory of everyone we have loved in our lives who enjoyed music. Let's make it a celebration for each of them." A quiet clapping from someone in the tenor section. It caught on. Then everyone clapped quietly, steadily. Peter came down the aisle to Arlene. "Stay for a minute, will you?" he said. "We have a cassock for you, but let's make sure of your size." Ward Hines was painfully stiff, but he helped the other men clank together the backs and seats of metal chairs. Katie Anderson collected all the music and brought it forward into a neat stack. Stan Garris went out into the kitchen and stopped them, packing up leftover sandwiches. He grabbed 8 of them and folded them into those sheets that threatened choir directors with prosecution if they made photocopies of photocopied anthems. He had no trouble finding Ward Hines still at the back. Stan's mother was holding out the jacket sleeve for the stiff old fellow. "Ride with us," Stan told him. "And, Mom, take these, will you? Divide them up when you get home, you and Ward and Michelle and the gang up at the apartments." At last, Peter and Natalie sat in their living room, martinis in hand. Peter's ears still heard how one person had started that light clapping and kept it up until the others in 2s and 3s, and finally everybody had joined in. His heart bloomed. It was mysterious to him that When he had stood in front of the singers and urged them to do their best for poor Eliza, he had felt sure of his message. Now that he was back home, he could not remember whether or not Eliza had ever shown any feeling for music. Now he was telling Natalie that he had been asked to fill in for an interim pastor service in New Hampshire late in January. He had been appointed to a visiting committee to Andover, too, to plan new film material for the school. He had hoped, he told Natalie, that he could combine those two trips, but it wouldn't work. They wanted him to take morning chapel on the Friday for the school, but the New Hampshire church had put him off another week. He had meant to keep news of the third gig to himself till it was a sure thing, but Natalie was looking so graceful and agreeable, even affable, as she sat down across from him that he blurted out, "And I may have to do a third trip," he told her, "Phillips Brooks' house." "Sounds wonderful," Natalie said. "Did they give you a subject, or have you chosen your own?" She almost never asked him about talks he got scheduled. She had not changed her clothes since the rehearsal. Even then, that no doubt smart, but to him harsh style of pin-striped suit, she was fine. He didn't detect a drop of sarcasm or irony about her at the moment. She was so often truculent about tiny issues, or so it felt to him, that this present, warm moment made him want to tell her everything in his heart. Even if old Nat drank too much, and mostly alone, he knew she still preferred to drink with him at the conventional cocktail hour. The combination of her beauty and her elegant relaxation touched him. She so often grew angry when he praised her that he now hesitated. He looked at her speculatively. How could he make her know how much he admired her kindness in sharing her music like this? What a beautiful rehearsal it had been. He wanted to exclaim that her leading that humdrum choir was a major, major kindness to ordinary people. He felt as if the world, well, all right, weren't such things bound to sound stupid, but still, if there were only more of such kindnesses, helping ordinary people make beautiful sounds, if there were more of that, then wouldn't the world, well, he didn't have to be specific about it. "Oh, Nat," he said, now rising to take the pitcher over to replenish her glass, "I so often feel guilty about your musical career." Her face went expressionless. He hung on to his idea anyway. He said, "I mean, if you and I had not lived here in the middle of the continent and raised our daughter here, you might have had a very different kind of career. In Boston, say, in New York, we have no way of guessing. European tours, maybe." Her face grew so irate that he hurried on. "But of course it is wonderful for this whole community, and for me, especially for me, that you exercise your talent here and brighten the lives of us all." "Drinks, Peter," she said. She had emptied her glass. "Yes, of course," he said hastily, but he called back over his shoulder from the ice bucket. "It's true, though, Nat. All that top-drawer career you've given up has been a huge boon to our community." Back in the living room, he refilled her glass. Her face had settled back into the obdurient expression that was habitual with her. Like all people who don't drink addictively, he had no real clue as to what made Natalie take four martinis instead of two each evening. And if he offered her only two, she would retire to the guest wing where she artfully hid her liquor. He himself never wanted to hold up with booze, especially in the middle of the day, as she sometimes did. He had no instinct to lie down on a guest bed in order to sleep off a half bottle of something. He supposed she didn't understand some of his pleasures either. Maybe she hadn't the slightest desire to fly east for a weekend in order to give a talk. And old friendships. She didn't seem to keep in touch with hers, old school or college roommates either. Still, what if she felt stuck back home, here in this uncultivated little town, while he got to address groups of variously educated people? "Nat, when I get jobs to give talks in different places, and now these three sermons..." "Not three whole sermons, is it, Peter?" she said. "One church sermon in New Hampshire, one 10-minute chapel address in prep school kids, one lay talk at Phillips Brooks' house." "Oh, of course you're right," he said, "but Nat, When I get jobs like this and take off for Duluth or Minneapolis Airport to fly to them, well, does it remind you that you have a huge talent in music and aren't getting much chance to fulfill it? She now upended her glass. She drank off the third entire straight-up martini that he had poured her a minute ago. No, Peter, it doesn't remind me of anything like that. I only wondered, he said. Doesn't remind me of anything like that, she repeated. For one thing, I haven't got any huge musical talent, and I never did have. What you see me and hear me doing is all I can do. I am a singing teacher. I am a director of an ecumenical choir who at their best sing at 1/3 volume. Most of them can't sight read at all. None of them, except Dieter, have the least idea of dynamics. What interest they do have is so low-key and childish that if we tried to run that choir an additional 6 weeks instead of just the October and November 6 we do have laid on, they'd quit. I am able to help the accompanist and the 2-string players do what they can, but at bottom, I look on them as damage control. Their mission is to be ready at all times to drown out the singers if worse comes to worse. Peter flung at her, but Nat, you shouted to them. You shouted, oh, my dears, sometimes you do a lovely job, cried Peter. You've praised them before, too, and did it again this afternoon, Natalie said calmly. I am a music teacher. I love good sound when I hear it. Sometimes, some of them this afternoon, even a critical mass of them, make good sound. I tell them when it happens. Now she stood up. I know you mean to be encouraging, Peter, but the truth is, I am just like you. I am a mid-sized fish of no particular color in a pond of no particular size. You and I were promoters. I'm not an artist. I am about one step better than a publicist about music. Yes, she called back over her shoulder on her way to the guest room. Her tone sounded malignant. A publicist like you, she added. We're both publicists for the nice life. He didn't mean to run after her and beg. His feet took him. Nonetheless, and when he caught up with her in front of the bookcase, well, he grasped her shoulders. You're coming back, Nat. Come on, we'll have another drink and we'll talk over what needs to be talked over. He looked at her infuriated face. He said, I don't think of my work as being publicist work, and I don't think of my community interests, like church and ecumenical choir, as publicist work, and I don't think of what you do as publicist work either. Damned if I must take such an insult, and damned if I can imagine why you would even want to make such demeaning remarks. He would give her a moment. Peter went around to 3 of the table lamps and lighted them. Now she spoke. She said, you always try to brighten and shine up everything. Drives me nearly crazy. He said, that's a lie. I wasn't trying to brighten up what you did and the singers over at church this afternoon. It was wonderful. So I said it was wonderful. She said, all right. So it was good community ambience, and I like singing, too. I think it is the more serious things that drive me crazy. When you try to gloss over very bad, cruel things, it drives me crazy. Peter, I thought it was my fault for years. It was only 4 years ago that I got it through my head that it was your fault. He waited. 4 years ago? 4 years ago? Nat said, you were always trying to get Imogene not to worry about Strog. She married him, Peter said in a brutal tone. Marriage is marriage. Nat went on. He had a propensity for recklessness, and you've got to have seen that just as well as I did. When they invited us up to that Thief River Falls place they'd rented, he couldn't help smiling at the recollection. He said, I'll never forget that. They were so happy in that wild place, all that nature and how they loved it. Do you remember how that one afternoon Strog supplied us all with guns and we walked through a cornfield looking to rouse up some pheasants? It had been a late Saturday afternoon in the fall. The farmer had picked, but not yet disked down, a 1/2 acre for plowing. Their little group took 4 rows feet apart. Only 2 pheasants got up at the end. Strog winged one, and Peter didn't get his gun up in time for the other. They started across another field. Suddenly, a rabbit leapt up. alternately jumping and galloping down rows, then cutting across, then coming back up toward him in another row. Get him," shouted Strug. Peter had no desire to kill that rabbit. Rabbits were Easter bunnies. Sharp seating of shell spread very near him. Strug had taken the animal cross row, right in front of Peter. For an excellent shot like Strug, it probably wasn't even dangerous. Peter came up to the dying animal. Its huge, amazing back leg still plunged and plunged in the corn leaves that the picker had left. Peter's daughter cried, "God damn it, you didn't have to do that, Strug." Her young husband ignored the remark. He came bounding across rows, breaking down more stubble. "Sorry, Pete," he said, "I didn't want to miss that one. He's a big fellow." He picked it up in front of Peter and broke its neck over backwards. Now Peter said to his wife, "He had to hand it to Strug how he had survival skills. He cleaned and skinned that rabbit for us. Told me the trick of the skinning, too, but darned if I can remember it. I think he soaked the piece in vinegar, not exactly a marinade. Then he rolled everything in whole wheat flour and tarragon. Don't you remember, Nat? Not only fried it for us, but he made a pan gravy, too." Nat said, "What I remember is how when the baby came, he loved it and would toss it up into the air and then catch it again." Peter smiled. "True enough, men do that. It irritates women, I know." Nat said, "Imogee used to leave the room." Peter was feeling nearly joyful. He was so relieved that they were just discussing the past in a civilized way. This was the first time he had been able to get Nat back on track, so to speak, once she lost her temper. It felt like a good omen to him. Chapter 14. The countryside between the Iron Range and Minneapolis looked wonderfully interesting to Emma Jean as she drove south. The November morning was so early that the sky hadn't yet drunk up any light from the sun. She was nearly weightless, happy with what little she could make out in the green-black hood of clouds. She had a delicate stomach, but otherwise was as strong as most people at age 34. She threw up a lot, but not in the car. Like any rural northerner in any helping profession, she knew her usual routes by heart. She knew where the rest stops were, where the less poisonous of the fast food sites were, where the most poisonous and most delicious were. She knew where you must watch for wild animals, although there were no crossing signs. Deer stood lightly on the highway shoulders. It was scary guesswork for them. They angled their heads this way and that, half drugged with headlights, deciding to cross, deciding no, no, don't cross after all, trying to make judgments with their tiny non-neocortical thinking sights, their pathetic amygdala. It had been hundreds of thousands of years since Imogene's species, Homo sapiens, had had to guide its terrors, its decisions by terror alone. She anticipated having a happy break from work. She liked her work, and she liked her life. She was a school social worker who was in love for the second time and happily so. On the other hand, she worked in what field of social work called a second setting. A primary setting was some place like an agency where there were other professional social workers, so you weren't the only person on the premises whose mission was different from everyone else's missions. A small school like St. Fursey Elementary and Middle School was always a secondary setting. The social worker was the only person with social work aims and social work ethical constraints. Everyone else had other professional goals. The superintendent was driven to maintain the entire structure. The principal wanted to keep the peace between administration and the parents. Over half of the teachers were saints. Imogene noticed that they invited little kids to getting a kick out of their own imaginations. Other teachers were so terrified of chaos or loss of power, they wouldn't trample flat any idea they hadn't heard of over and over. Scarcely mattered if the idea came from adults or children. If it was original was all very well and good, but you couldn't tell where it might go. Some teachers even rolled their eyes to the rest of the class, inviting them to sneer. Oh, quietly, not really sneering, of course not, only trying to show the fact that, look, you had to have a sense of humor about some things. Imogene was like an old fox with its own bag of tricks. She watched her back. She had even stood off the bullhead principal, Donald Menzies. Still, how wonderful it was to be driving by herself in the lightning day to the MSSWA conference. She planned to park outside the Earl Brown Center just as the keynote speaker was being introduced. That way she could slide into a back seat and hear him without much prefacing. Later, she would find some colleagues and eat lunch with them. The whole day she would not have to protect her psychological or physical space from a principal or anyone else. Everyone would trade real truths instead of small talk. How had they liked their plenary guy? What was the beastliest thing that had happened in their school recently? What great moment of truth had they rejoiced in recently? In the crush of the lunch line, she found her friends all right, but one of them had brought along a guest. As non-professionals sometimes did when visiting helping professionals, this guest brought out some psychological theories to make an impression. She said she hadn't liked the keynote speaker because he talked about evil verbatim, and any ethical practitioner knows that one person's evil isn't someone else's everyday custom. They all ate steadily from their sandwich boxes, which were full of food that was bad for you, but tasted wonderful. The conversation moved on, turned to men, and Emma Jean perked up a little. The guest said that the real attraction between men and women was mutual high-mindedness. She went on about it some, and the others dumped out the chips and commercial cookies and offered them around to one another with raised eyebrows. It seemed too bad that no one picked up on such a cheerful idea, as men and women are initially attracted to one another by intuiting like-minded idealism. Nothing about the idea was unpleasant. Imogen couldn't help win the conversation, however, because her attraction to Vern, her current squeeze, was his sandy-colored hair. You just can't join some conversation with the remark that you preferred sandy-colored body hair as well as sandy-colored head hair, and that you had been delighted to find Vern had it, now that you two had got to know each other in the past 2 weeks. And that she had noticed the sandy-colored hair before she knew he had quit a high-paying position because his company tortured rabbits as part of product development. No matter how comfy the little table of acquaintances who had managed to get their lunch trays and take them over to a table, you couldn't add that into a conversation just to put a guest at her ease. And it wouldn't improve anything if you further added that not only did you like the sandy-colored hair of your present man, but it had been a factor in how you had chosen your husband, too, from whom you were now divorced. Imogene merely listened for a while. The others consulted their packets to make choices for the afternoon. Imogene looked about until she caught sight of the morning speaker. She went gingerly between the hilarious or raucous or shy-sounding table conversations along the way. He stopped eating to smile at her. His face said, "You may tell me you loved my talk this morning. Others have been doing that." Or his face said, "For whatever reason you have come to speak with me, it is okay with me." "Just a question," Imogene said. "I was just wondering if you ever take a last-minute emergency client for a session." He said without any pause at all, "That's the main kind. Hang on a second." He laid down his fork and got a card out of his jacket pocket. This encouraged her enough so she could lie cheerfully to the table group about why she'd had a word with the speaker. Now the guest at their table was announcing that you lose power only if you give it away. "No one can take power from you," she said. Imogene felt too buoyed up inside herself to ask for some examples, or why it was that those with money and educational privilege seemed to manage all sorts of stunts when single moms in poorish rural towns couldn't pull off. She had paid for the conference. They had her money. They had given her one totally good speech. She needn't give them her time as well. So now she longed for her own life, which she had left at 4:30 that morning. She decided to leave for home.
You've been listening to episode 17 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.